And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr. This program is designed for English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. This is what you will hear on today's program. Andrew Smith and Jill Robbins tell how some college professors are teaching about conspiracy theories. I'll talk to Andrew about what he found. After that, learn expressions for trying times in words and their stories. Then, listen for our America's Presidents series. But first, John Russell has this about the international effects of bird flu.
Avian flu has reached new areas of the world and has become a year-round problem, animal and disease experts warn. More than 20 experts and farmers on four continents spoke to the Reuters news agency about the problem. They suggested that record outbreaks will not stop soon on poultry farms. They also warned that farmers must view the disease as a serious risk all year, instead of doing prevention efforts during spring movement seasons for wild birds. The outbreaks of the virus have continued through the summer heat and winter cold in North and South America, Europe, Asia, and Africa. Egg prices set records after the disease killed tens of millions of chickens last year. These record prices, at a time of worldwide economic problems, are especially damaging to people who use eggs as a main source of protein. Wild birds are mainly responsible for spreading the virus, experts say. Waterfowl, like ducks, can carry the disease without dying and pass it to poultry through contaminated waste, saliva, and other means. Farmers' best efforts to protect their birds are falling short. In the United States, Roseacre Farms, the country's second-largest egg producer, lost about 1.5 million chickens at a Guthrie County, Iowa, production farm last year. These losses occurred even though anyone who entered barns was required to shower first to remove any sign of the virus, Chief Executive Marcus Rust said. A company farm in Weld County, Colorado, was infected twice within about 6 months, killing more than 3 million chickens, Rust said. He thinks wind blew the virus in from nearby fields where geese left their waste. The U.S., Britain, France, and Japan are among the countries that have suffered record losses of poultry over the past year, leaving some farmers feeling helpless. Avian flu is occurring even in a new poultry farm with modern equipment and no windows, so all we could do now is ask God to avoid an outbreak, said Shigeo Inaba, who raises chickens for meat in Ibaraki, near Tokyo. Wild birds have spread the disease farther and wider around the world than ever before, likely carrying record amounts of the virus, said Gregorio Torres. Torres is the head of the science department at the Paris-based World Organization for Animal Health, an intergovernmental group for animal diseases. The virus changed from previous outbreaks to a form that is probably more easily spread, he told Reuters. I'm John Russell.
In November 2018, about 600 people gathered for a two-day convention in Denver, Colorado. They wore clothes saying, "The Earth is flat." They listened to speakers who rejected findings from the American Space Agency, NASA, and much of the scientific community. They believed that the Earth is a flat, thin, round object as seen in pictures taken from space. Many pseudoscience claims are often connected to conspiracy theories. In addition to Flat Earth, the Colorado Sun reported that many attendees believed that vaccines do not protect against disease, and they did not believe the Apollo moon landings, the Sandy Hook shooting, and the attack on September 11th were real. Among the attendees at the Flat Earth Convention was Craig Foster. He is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York, SUNY, Cortland. He went to the convention to study the ways flat earthers think, communicate, and experience their gatherings.
Foster now teaches a class called Psychology of Pseudoscience at SUNY Cortland. The class helps students understand why people believe in and support pseudoscience. Pseudo means not real. Pseudoscience is a collection of theories and practices mistakenly believed by supporters as being based on science. Foster wrote in The Conversation that the class explores two issues, motivated reasoning and group polarization. Motivated reasoning is the tendency for people to process information in a way that helps them confirm what they already want to believe. For example, this can lead them to rely on only one or two examples to support their claims while ignoring other information. People also tend to socialize with groups of people who agree with them. Foster said that once people become involved socially and connect a belief to their identity, it becomes increasingly difficult for them to give up those beliefs, even if the claims are false. Foster told VOA,
"A big driver of the problem, the real driver, is when people are so invested, they just can't see their way out of it anymore."
Jared Acheson teaches a class called Conspiracy Theories in American Public Discourse at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He said the internet has affected the spread of false claims, and many colleges now offer classes centering on misinformation. Acheson said conspiracy groups like QAnon would invite their online followers to find evidence to support a claim. Rather than relying on a few experts, conspiracy movements can now get thousands of people to join in the building of the beliefs. Acheson told VOA,
"But it's been amplified in our new media environment. It's so much more participatory because anybody can get credibility in that community if they have a creative interpretation of what's being put out into the world."
Both Foster and Acheson train students to understand the ways promoters of pseudoscience and conspiracies think. Acheson helps students form what he calls argument maps, which show the ways conspiracy theorists build their arguments. Once students can read the map, they can develop a plan to push back against the conspiracy. In Foster's class, students must create their own pseudoscientific claim and write a paper supporting it. One student even wrote what Foster calls a pseudo-historical paper, claiming that owls are intelligent aliens who have been secretly controlling humans for centuries. Foster said there are pseudoscientific claims his students sometimes believe are true, such as astrology and creationism. Astrology is the belief that the relative position of stars influences a person's personality and life events. Creationism denies the theory of human evolution. He said these cases force students to examine their own reasoning. Both professors brought guest speakers to their classes, including supporters of Bigfoot, an ape-like creature 2.5 meters tall, believed to live in the northwestern U.S. and Canada. Foster wants his students to understand that believers in Bigfoot, ghosts, or psychics are not crazy or unintelligent. He added that arguing with these believers rarely changes their views, and students need to learn how to communicate respectfully with people whose beliefs may differ from their own. Foster's class also looked at the danger of the anti-vaccination movements, investments run by psychics, and denial of climate change. And Acheson talked about an exercise from the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, last year. The exercise imagined an asteroid hitting Winston-Salem, home to about 250,000 people. Acheson said,
"And they came to the conclusion that 20% of Winston-Salem would not evacuate because they would not trust the message. They would not trust NASA and they would not trust FEMA."
He said, "NASA and FEMA are starting to ask the same question. With science as politicized as it is today, how do we talk about this stuff in a way that could persuade people when their lives might depend on it?" I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
I'm Mario Ritter, Jr., and you're listening to VOA Learning English. Now, we're going to hear more from Andrew Smith about university classes on pseudoscience and conspiracy theories. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Mario. It's a pleasure to be here.
Andrew, some of our listeners may be asking themselves, why do some people start believing pseudoscientific claims while most people don't believe them?
According to Professor Foster, one answer to that question is surprisingly simple. People were simply introduced to the false claims before they had formed a clear understanding of the issue. To explain this, Foster mentions the rooftop theory from the book How We Know What Isn't So by Thomas Gilovich. At the top of a steep roof, a person can go down either the side of pseudoscience or science. But if they go down the pseudoscience side, it gets harder and harder for them to climb back up, because of all the flaws in human reasoning Foster mentions.
How did Professor Acheson become interested in conspiracy theories?
Acheson was researching the language that Jefferson Davis, the leader of the Southern states in the U.S. Civil War, used to try to persuade people to support the South. Slavery was legal in the Southern states. The war took place from 1861 to 1865, but before the war, Davis had spread conspiracy claims about Abraham Lincoln, who became president of the U.S. just before the war started. Acheson saw that conspiracy theories have had an impact throughout U.S. history, even back to the times of its first president, George Washington.
How do the professors think society can prevent the spread of misinformation?
They both say the answer is education. Foster compares it with getting medicine. Just as a vaccine protects against disease, education can protect people from believing harmful pseudoscientific beliefs and conspiracy theories. Acheson told me that more and more academic fields are now offering classes that study misinformation. These include political science, cultural studies, philosophy, psychology, and communications.
Well, as the book suggests, it can be important to know why something isn't right.
I sure think so.
Have you ever heard the expression, out of the frying pan into the fire? Anna Mateo explains all about it on the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories.
And now, Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore idioms or expressions in the English language. We give examples and notes on usage. And sometimes we even use them in short stories. Today, we talk about bad situations. Sometimes we think a situation is very bad. We cannot imagine that it can get any worse. But then, it does. We have an expression for just that situation, out of the frying pan and into the fire. Imagine we are camping. The area is near a small river. So for dinner, we decide to go fishing. Fish cooked over a campfire is a tasty meal indeed. We start the fire. We add butter and onions to the frying pan. When it heats up, we add the fish. In the frying pan, the fish is in a very bad situation. It flips violently back and forth. It tries to get out of the hot frying pan. Finally, the fish flips out of the frying pan, but lands in the fire. The idiom, out of the frying pan and into the fire, means you leave a bad situation purposefully, only to find yourself in a much worse situation. You thought you were improving it, but the opposite happened. Sometimes this saying describes a choice between two equally difficult options. Here is another example. Let's say your friend complains about his job all the time. He says his commute to the office is too long and the pay is too low. You remind him that he gets great benefits, and he has the freedom to set his own hours. You tell him that no job is perfect, but he does not listen. He leaves his job and starts another one. When you talk to him a month later, this is how the conversation might go.
Hey, how's the new job going?
To be honest, not so good.
Oh no, what's wrong?
Well, I used to set my own hours. My new job has a strict 9-to-5 policy.
Being able to set your own hours is a big plus.
And my take-home pay might be more, but I have to pay so much more for health insurance. And I have to pay for a parking space.
Sounds like you've jumped out of the frying pan and into the fire.
Please don't remind me.
And here is a final note on usage. If the friend in this conversation simply said, "Sounds like you just jumped out of the frying pan," we would know they mean this expression. Some word experts say this phrase comes from very early Greek poetry. Those early poets used the expression to describe the process of trying to escape smoke and getting burned by the flames instead. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Do you have a question about an idiom or expression? Send us an email to voalearningenglish.com and let us know. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
And now, the first episode in our America's Presidents series. Kelly Jean Kelly talks about how the institution of the presidency came about.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are not going to talk about any one president. We will instead talk about the presidency itself, what some people call the office of the presidency. That does not mean the room where the leader of the United States works. Here, it means the position and powers of the U.S. president. Sidney Milkus is part of the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. He and others at the Miller Center are specialists on U.S. political history. Milkus says that when it was created in the late 1700s, the U.S. presidency was unlike any other position in world history.
For thousands of years before the American Constitution, people thought a strong executive power and a democracy, what Jefferson called self-government, were incompatible. Because how could a sovereign, a people, delegate tremendous responsibility to one individual and still consider themselves a democracy, even a representative democracy?
In other words, the idea of giving a lot of power to one person made sense if the country were a monarchy and ruled by a king or queen. And giving a lot of power to an elected group in a legislature made sense if the country were a democracy and voters elected representatives. But giving a lot of power to one person in a democracy did not seem to make sense. The writers of the Constitution understood this situation. They were concerned about giving one person too much power. Remember, the country's founders had just fought a war for independence against the British. The American colonists had not liked being under the control of a British king. They also worried that a strong executive could become a tyrant or corrupt, adds Harry Rubinstein. He is a curator at the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. But the Constitution's writers had also seen the problems of a weak executive branch. Asking state legislatures to make national decisions took too long, and sometimes the problems were never resolved at all. Historian Sidney Milkus says that, as a result of these ideas, some of them conflicting, the writers of the Constitution argued about what the office of the president should be.
There were people like James Madison and Jefferson who thought the president's power should be limited, and the term president meant preside, and Congress and the states should be the leading venues of American democracy.
Other people who helped write the U.S. Constitution, such as Alexander Hamilton, thought the president should be what Milkus calls the anchor of American democracy. Hamilton thought the president should have enough power to direct large projects for the public good. So what happened? Well, in 1787, delegates to the Constitutional Convention found a unique solution. First, they agreed to make the president a one-person job. One person, they reasoned, could both make decisions more effectively than a group and be more easily held responsible for them. But they decided not to give the president too much power. The person would be elected for 1 4-year term at a time, and the president would share power with a national legislature and a Supreme Court. The delegates also decided some of the details about how the president would be elected and how to remove the person from office. And they said the president would have a number of duties. They include being the commander-in-chief of the military, nominating public officials, and giving Congress a report on the State of the Union. This list comes from Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution. But a lot of the job description was left open. It said, "The president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed." Since it was written in 1787, that expression has informed discussions about what powers the U.S. president should really have. Historian Sidney Milkus says Americans are still debating how much power the president should have. For most of the 19th century, he says, the powers of the president were more limited. But since the 20th century, the position has become more powerful. The president has moved closer to the center of American democracy. But in time, Milkus says, Americans may decide to limit the president's authority again and give more power to Congress and state governments. Milkus adds one more thing about the unusual invention of the U.S. president. It was unclear that the public would trust a national executive. But as our America's President series shows, for the most part, Americans respect the office of the president. Instead of fearing our great leaders, says Milkus, we honor them. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America.